The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. My guest is Jay Polosky. He is the founder and principal of Polosky Global Strategies, a global investment advisory boutique based in New York City. The firm was formerly known as J to Z Advisory. But today known as Polosky Global Strategies, and the firm analyzes the interplay between global economics, politics, policy, and markets for the benefit of its clients. Jay Polosky has more than 30 years of investing experience in 50 different countries, as well as 20 plus years of global multi-asset investment experience. He is former head of global asset allocation strategy at Morgan Stanley. And he has more than 15 years of ETF investing experience. He founded Polosky Global Strategies in 2011 to offer independent investment advice to institutional clients across both public and private, as well as active and passive investing categories. And Jay Polosky joins us by phone from the Big Apple to discuss his contention that the globalization movement is over and will eventually be replaced by a multipolar economic world. Jay, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
You know, this the timing for this discussion couldn't be better. Right now, I think there's more tumult around the world than we have seen since maybe the 1960s. And you've come to the conclusion that, obviously a lot of this tumultuous environment has been created by this tremendous pushback against globalization. And you've come to the conclusion that globalization is over. Why do you come to that conclusion?
Well, you know what, Mike, I totally agree with your point of view that things are kind of in flux. And to my way of thinking, it's actually very conducive for my view of the world, which I call the tripolar world, as you note, the argument being that we're moving from kind of pure globalization to a more regional deepening or regional integration process, which I hope I'm sure we'll be able to discuss here on the program. But I believe this really began back in 2008 with the Great Financial Crisis, which I argue really killed all three global growth models that were in place at that point in time. The first one was the U.S. debt finance consumption model, which of course was killed in 2008-09. The second was the European vendor financing model, where the West European banks would lend to the southern periphery, Portugal, Greece, Spain, et cetera, on very low interest rates, rates that those countries hadn't seen for years. That led to overconsumption, excess debt, and of course that model also fell apart post-2008. And then the third model was the emerging market model of exporting to the Western developed economies. Likewise, that model collapsed in 2008. And really, for the last 8 years, we've been very dependent on essentially central bank monetary policy, with a little bit of an exception with China's stimulus program in 2009-2010. But there's been really, in my argument, the way I see the world as a global investor and advisor, is that there's been very little articulation about how do we revive global growth. That there's been a fixation really on the merits of central bank policy. You know, what's Yellen going to do? What's Mario Draghi going to do? What is Mr. Kuroda going to do in the Bank of Japan? And so I think we've been overly fixated and wrongly fixated on pure monetary policy. And at the same time, we've had a situation where finance, which was really the tip of the globalization spear when you think about capital flows in the 90s and early 2000s into the emerging economies, et cetera, that's clearly been rolled back. You look at the focus of the big banks today, whether they're European, American, Japanese, Chinese, et cetera, they're all much more focused on their domestic markets than they were 10 years ago. And then more recently, of course, the Washington consensus, the idea of globalization as we know it, has kind of, in my words, been found to be politically toxic when you think about Brexit in the UK over the last year or so, and then, of course, the election of Donald Trump on a very nationalist America First policy program. And so we're in a situation where We need a new model, and the model that I've come up with and really been developing, and I've been writing about it for the last 4 or 5 years, is this idea of a tripolar world.
So let me ask you about this information age terminology that has been used for a long, long time. I think there's people who would make the argument, I would make the argument, let me put it that way, that we've been talking about the information age for a long time, but it's only really started to land in the last handful of years, and it has caused tremendous displacement. Because when we stop and think about why are people so dissatisfied with globalization, well, a lot of jobs have been sent overseas. Let's talk from a U.S. standpoint for just a moment. A lot of jobs sent overseas. And now some of those manufacturing jobs have come back in very diminished form. They've come back because automation is able to do them with far fewer people. And so the argument that, you know, a lot of these jobs that went away are never coming back, and they don't even exist where they went to, not certainly not in the form that they originally went over there. Is it this information age, the technology revolution, the thing that you think is triggering all the dissatisfaction that is making people say this economic system doesn't work anymore? And let me add one other thing, Jay. You've probably seen some of this polling that's been done by Pew Research and others, that there are people who are really questioning whether we should have capitalism anymore. It's almost as though capitalism, which has always been touted as the economic system that does the most good for the most people, now is being really held under the spotlight. And there's a lot of people saying, look, if this is the best capitalism can do, I think maybe capitalism isn't the road we want to go down anymore, which is a pretty scary proposition when you consider what the alternatives have been to date. I know that's I've thrown a lot at you, Jay, but I know you're a smart guy and you can sort your way through it.
Mike, that was that's a lot to cover there. But yeah, well, you know, you can touch on the issue of inequality. I mean, I think the way you put it, you know, capitalism provides the most good for the most people. I mean, clearly, you know, the inequality that's been manifested over the last decade or so would call that into question. And I think that's a lot of what we've seen, together with, as you pointed out, the hollowing out of some industries, and I would argue the failure of policymakers to address those folks who have been left behind. And I think that's what we saw at Brexit, and that's what we saw to a large extent with the election of Donald Trump. The folks who have really been left behind in this world, this new world that's shaping up, are pushing back against that and saying, hey, look, you've got to pay attention to us. And hey, the great news is that both the UK and the US are democracies, and people were able to express this point of view through the ballot box, or in the case of Brexit, obviously a referendum. In the case of Donald Trump being elected president in a presidential election. And so I think that suggests the system is still working. But as I pointed out in my introductory comments, you know, we've had a kind of unilateral focus on monetary policy, which, by the way, is for the most part done by unelected officials, right, in the central banks of the world. So we need the elected officials to get on the case. And my view is that the tripolar world allows that, and I'm starting to see it happen. And let me give you a couple of examples of how I see this playing out. So my view is that the tripolar world is coming into play across both the economic issues that we've touched on, the political world that we've spoken about, and the technology that you mentioned, and corporate behavior. And so in essence, the tripolar world argues that regional deepening or regional integration in the three main regions of Asia, Europe, and the Americas, so not just the U.S., but the Americas writ large, can catalyze the global economy onto a new growth path. And there are three new and mutually reinforcing factors that underpin this thesis, and they are as follows. Each region's growing ability to, one, self-finance via new wealth pools. So if you think about the development of pensions in the emerging markets, for example, in Chile or Mexico, or if you think about the development of China's financial markets, which are now the number two equity market and I think the number three bond market in the world, or you think about the development in the last decade of the European corporate bond market, which traditionally corporates in Europe have been very bank dependent. Given all that's going on with the banks in Europe, there's been a real development of a corporate bond market in Europe, which is very conducive for growth in that particular part of the world or that particular region. The second factor is the ability to self-produce. And you touched on it with manufacturing, but But as we move into an advanced manufacturing world where robotics, 3D printing, the advent of mass customization really starts to take hold, then the thesis becomes you want to be close to the consumer and you want to produce really in each main region. And you're starting to see that happen, and we can talk about that, particularly in the context of the Americas, and the interplay between the U.S. and Mexico is a perfect example of that. And now the third thesis is one that's really kind of in the ethos or in the air when we talk about things like technology, and that's the ability to self-consume. And I argue that through the rise of urbanization, as more people live in cities, the rise of service sector economies, as more production gets done with fewer people at lower costs, we're moving into more and more countries are dependent on their service sectors. And then, of course, e-commerce, that is driving this integration that I'm speaking about. And we really, Mike, if you think about it, and you touched on jobs moving overseas, in my way of thinking, we've moved from a world where there was this search for low-cost labor, and people and companies were extending their supply chain 3,000 miles to get to that low-cost labor. And as you pointed out, today in China, for example, wages are going up at roughly 20% per annum, so those jobs don't even really exist in China. China, in fact, is the world's biggest user of industrial robots. The biggest market for industrial robots is now in China. So that we've moved and are moving from a world where it was all about where can I find the low-cost labor to a world where it's all about the consumer. And that consumer sees something they like, often on their phone, they order it on their phone, and they expect it to be delivered and to have physical possession of that item within 24 hours. And that is something that you can't do unless you're located very closely, and I would argue not simply nationally, but the regional integration is how this is going to shape out.
So if this comes to pass, Jay, and we have a multipolar, tripolar economic world order, would each of those regions in your vision be dominated by one or two economic powers, or would it be much more egalitarian than that?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I believe it will be a little bit of a hub and spokes kind of network. And let me touch on how I view each region at the moment. So I have a term for each of the three regions. And in Asia, I start with Asia as the proactive region. And that has been being led by China, so it kind of touches on your question. In China, through two particular policy measures, is really leading the integration of Asia. The first is the recent launch over the past couple of years of what is known as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. So that's a bank that China is the principal shareholder, and it is meant to facilitate capital being moved to infrastructure projects throughout Asia. Most of the other countries in Asia are part of that bank, but China is the leader in that process. The U.S., for example, is not part of that, and argued strenuously with a number of our allies at the time to not join it. And we were rebuffed because, of course, if you're in Asia, you kind of have to be involved with China. It's just simply too big to ignore. The second project is really leading Asian integration, and in turn is being led by China, is what is known as the One Belt, One Road Infrastructure Project, or the OBER Project. And that is designed to really stitch Asia and increasingly Eurasia together, both over land, where China's kind of replicating the traditional old Silk Road, as well as in a maritime fashion. So there's port development, stitching all of Asia together throughout that region. And the third factor, much more recent, in fact, just in the past couple of months, has been the U.S. decision under President Trump to move away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which really opens the door for China to assert leadership in the Asian integration. So that's Asia. In Europe, I call Europe the reactive region. And I say that because really since the financial crisis, Europe has been fighting fires of one kind or another, whether they're financial crisis in Greece or Brexit more recently, but it's been a firefighting exercise. However, where we are today, I argue that the combination of Brexit and President Trump and his kind of negative perspective on NATO and other parts of Europe has really served to bring the Europeans closer together, and they've recognized the need that they need to move forward as a region. And this has been catalyzed by the recent election of President Macron in France and the likelihood of the re-election of German Chancellor Merkel to reassert the traditional Franco-German engine that typically leads European integration. And so from my perspective, again, kind of getting to your point about countries, France and Germany, traditionally the leaders to Europe's integration, Britain has now separated itself from the European Union, so it offers an opportunity for France and Germany to come together again. New visionary president in France, older, experienced leader in Chancellor Merkel. I'm very positive on Europe, and I think the next 3 to 5 years, Europe is really the place to be. And I think the new name for Europe is going to be Europe Resurgent as opposed to Europe Reactive. Now, that leaves, obviously, the third region, and that's the Americas. And unfortunately, I term the Americas the inactive region. And that's because we really, in North America, with NAFTA, provided the blueprint for what I call Tripolar World 1.0, which was really the U.S. as consumer, Canada as a natural resource provider, and Mexico as the low-cost manufacturing base. But really, in the last 20 years, we've done nothing to build on that very positive beginning, in large part because of some of the points that you made, Mike, where politically speaking, NAFTA is kind of a stepchild. Nobody has really wanted to own NAFTA. However, the world we're in today, 20 years later, I would argue that we need to not only own NAFTA, but I think there's a tremendous opportunity for the U.S. to demonstrate leadership by extending it southward and incorporating South and Central America, which is, by the way, home to 500 million people, which would give the Americas writ large, our region, the heft to compete with Asia and Europe. And interestingly enough, the political winds in South and Central America are very favorable for this. One of the things you may have noted in my bio was early in my career in the 90s, I was very actively involved in the equity markets in Latin America and have followed them ever since. And I can assure you that politically speaking, the interest in working more closely with the United States to develop economic growth is very high on the agenda for the South and Central American countries. And I would argue that President Trump is probably the only U.S. politician that could sell a deeper integration with the Americas to the heartland of the United States. Much as Nixon was the anti-communist strong enough to open China for the U.S., I think President Trump has an opportunity to sell or to make the case why broader integration of the Americas is going to be good for all of the United States. And I would end by simply saying that I believe the failure to move in this direction could leave the U.S. And the Americas writ large at risk to falling behind the other two regions, as we have that resurgent Europe and we have an Asia that is being led and being integrated very rapidly by China. So there's a strategic as well as an economic implication for the U.S. And I really am concerned that if we don't move in this direction, 5 years, 10 years down the road, we're going to wake up and realize that the Americas far in the United States, far from being kind of that unipolar moment that we saw in the 90s and 2000 after the end of the Cold War, where we were kind of astride the world by ourselves, the hegemon, as the French used to call it. You know, we're going to be looking at a world that has a very large and powerful growing Europe and a very large and powerful and growing Asia. And we're going to be sitting there going, jeepers, we need to come up with something fast. And that's not where you want to be.
Where does this leave Russia? And I ask because Vladimir Putin desperately wants to be a global player. He wants to be a player on the world stage. He's made that abundantly clear. It doesn't appear that Russia, which has become a pariah state at this stage, it doesn't appear that Russia fits into the tripolar world order.
Well, you know, that's a great question, Mike, and I would say a couple of things. First, you know, Russia has nukes. So they are always going to be a global player. Secondly, if you think about that tripolar world 1.0 that I used to reference the U.S. as consumer, Canada natural resource provider, Mexico low-cost manufacturer, I think arguably that you had the same thing in Europe with the introduction of the euro. So tripolar world 1.0 in Europe was Western Europe as the consumer, Russia as the natural resource provider, and Eastern and Central Europe as the low-cost manufacturing base. And now, I think Russia, given some of its geopolitical moves, I think is, as you say, on the outside looking in. And their big question, and I think is, and a question for China, is how do they fit in not only to Europe, but to China's desire to kind of extend the Asian integration into Eurasia? And there they're kind of moving into what Russia would like to think of as kind of its own backyard. So if you think of the Stans, right, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, et cetera, the One Belt, One Road project moves through that region. And I think Russia is not only going to be pressured insofar as how does it think about its role in Europe, but it's also going to be pressured because I think it's going to see China moving much more aggressively and much more assertively in parts of the world that it considers kind of its own backyard. So on the European side, you have the whole question of the Ukraine. On the China side, on the Central Asian side, you have the whole question of the One Belt, One Road project moving through that region. So I think Russia, which, you know, essentially is a, I call it a petrostate. It's a country that is very dependent on oil and the price of oil. And if you believe, as I do, that oil is not particularly attractive on a medium to longer term because of how aggressively technology is reshaping the oil market, then I think Russia really needs to think about where does it sit. And it may well sit outside of the tripolar world. And again, I would argue that that is not a place where you want to be. And you also have other places, other parts of the world, like Africa and the Middle East, that at the moment do not really fit into the tripolar world thesis as I see it. That doesn't mean, of course, that they fall off the map and they disappear. It just means that they're not going to be, they're going to be left behind as these regions, these three main regions, deepen their integration and take advantage of the technology and the consumption and the e-commerce and the financial capacity that we touched on a few minutes ago.
You know, in the interest of poking a little bit at your assumptions in Asia, China does not get along well with its neighbors. It doesn't get along with its neighbors well at all. It seems to do better in Africa. They're warming. They have a warming relationship with Mexico. And the counterbalance to China for a lot of these Asian nations is cozying up to the United States as leverage against China. So how does China deal with that? Or is that the weak link in your model for Asia, Jay?
Well, I think, again, very solid question. And you know, I had an opportunity a couple of years ago to do a good research trip in China. And one of the things I did was visit some of the embassies of the Asian countries in China. So we went to the Australian embassy, the New Zealand embassy, a couple of others. And, you know, when you do that, you realize that the China as an economic engine is simply too big to be ignored. And so, yes, absolutely correct that for historical reasons, some going back hundreds and thousands of years, some going back to World War II, et cetera, you know, there's not a lot of love lost between China and some of its neighbors. And look, other countries are going to want to have a role and a voice in Asia. You think of Japan, you think of India, you think of South Korea, you think of Indonesia, and that's going to happen. But and that's why I'm saying that the integration is not so much single country led, though I think China probably has a bigger role to play in Asia because of its relative heft within the region and because of its aggressive moves through such things as One Belt, One Road. It probably is going to dominate Asia more than any single country would in Europe. I think Europe is going to be the Franco-German engine I spoke of. And in the United States, in the Americas, I think the U.S. has the potential to be the dominant player. My worry there, of course, is that we don't seize the opportunity, as I mentioned earlier. So, yeah, China has challenges in dealing with its neighbors. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, China needs to employ its people. China needs to grow its economy. China needs to move away from the excess investing in poorly low productive state-owned enterprises, and they need to shift to a much more dynamic private sector model. And part of the One Belt, One Road process is meant to kind of take some of that excess investment and some of that knowledge that they've developed in the infrastructure of the Chinese economy and put it overseas. And so I think that the good news there, as I would see it, obviously from a more optimistic perspective, is that China is less likely to be combative or to be overly assertive, given its desire to grow its economy and to link the rest of the region, which will facilitate its growth. If it can't grow at the rate it needs to simply by fueling domestic demand, that game is over for China. And one of the things I learned, Mike, for example, at the end of that research trip was that the stimulus package that China introduced in 2010 is now widely seen as a mistake, because that was the opportunity for China to blame the West for the collapse of the financial markets and the great financial crisis. And then the authorities there, the leadership there, could have used that argument to pivot its economy to the private sectors I just discussed. They did not do that. They doubled down on stimulus, and now that doubling down on the stimulus has left China with a very large debt load, which A, precludes them from doing it again, and B, requires them to move more aggressively in trying to generate non-domestic sources of growth, such as the One Belt, One Road project.
So if things sort out as predicted into this tripolar world, will this be positive or negative for economies around the world, the economies that are actually aligned with each of these three regions in their respective region? Jay, do you expect that we're going to see the GDP of these nations growing robustly, or do you think we're kind of in a, there are some economists who think the new normal is going to be 1% growth?
Well, I think there are. I have some sympathy for the low growth world argument, and clearly we've been in that low growth world for a couple of years. And there are some very powerful factors that drive that. One of them, of course, is demographics in the developed economies. Right, we're getting older, with a lot more folks retiring, not really super productive. The other issue, of course, is that low productivity, which is a great question to a lot of people. We have all these technological advances, but yet don't seem to be generating a whole lot of productivity. And therefore, you know, those are the two big drivers to growth, are demographics and productivity, and both of them have been subpar. And that's why I argue that the tripolar world, this regional deepening, regional integration, can catalyze a more robust growth path. Now, whether it goes from, let's say, in the developed world, OECD countries are growing roughly 2%, emerging economies growing roughly 5%, total global GDP growth roughly 3%, you know, maybe we get another percentage point of global growth. Maybe the developed economies can grow more at a 2.5% to 3% rate as they integrate in Europe, and as we leverage that, for example, in the Americas, if we leverage those 500 million potential consumers that exist south of Mexico, that presents a real opportunity for the United States, and vice versa for those economies as well. Similarly, in Asia, which is, of course, the high-growth region in the world, but you've seen China decelerate from 10% plus growth to something much more like 6%, probably on its way to 4%. The ability of the rest of Asia to kind of be stitched together, to be more productive, to have better infrastructure, to leverage the e-commerce that's taking place in Asia, to kind of link together the ASEAN countries of Southeast Asia, their potential growth path could also be higher. And so to me, it's all about finding ways to grow beyond monetary policy. I think we've come to the end of monetary policy. Fiscal policy is problematic, as we see here in the United States. As we see in Europe, there's not a huge appetite for large fiscal stimulus because we still have large debt loads, and therefore there's not the budgetary flexibility for fiscal stimulus. So I think we need to come up with something else. And the something else that I at least have come up with, and which I think is really coming to fruition because of some of the inputs that I laid out at the earlier stage of our conversation. To me, it is a growth path, a catalyst for growth that has a real opportunity to leverage that those new wealth pools in the different regions, to leverage this advanced manufacturing that clearly is happening. You can't fight it, because if you fight it, you're not competitive and you're out of business. So the question is, how do you leverage it? And then you have that consumption factor, which is the rise of urbanization, the development of the service sector economy, and e-commerce, all of which, as you see, you know, you look at Amazon, you look at the stock price of Sears versus the stock price of Amazon. You know, look at some of the logistics companies. The stocks of some of the logistics companies that facilitate the distribution of the e-commerce sales. So it's a world that is in flux, and as an investor and as an advisor to folks who are investing institutional capital, you know, we need to be on the path of participating in the growth segments. And to me, the tripolar regional deepening thesis is a growth story.
So if this vision comes to pass, what does it mean, Jay, in terms of the flow of goods? Are we going to start seeing a more tightly knit flow of goods, or is it still going to be just as global as ever?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that meshing together of regional economies and regional demand, it's you know, as I touched on earlier, for the last 20, 25 years, it's been all about the 3,000-mile-long global supply chain. And now, in going forward, I think it's going to be all about the corporate value-added supply chain that, for example, exists in the automotive sector between the U.S. and Mexico, or exists, for example, in Europe between the economies of Central and Eastern Europe and the more traditional developed economies, or in the case of Asia, the stitching together, the One Belt, One Road. I mean, you now have trains, Mike, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there are now trains that leave China and go all the way to the UK and vice versa. Take 3 weeks, but it's way faster and way less expensive than shipping by transporting by ship, going the sea route. So this is the trade is going to be there. But it's not going to be from 3,000 miles away. It's going to be from producing much closer to where the consumer is. If you think, for example, a couple of factors that I'm trying to do more work on is just understanding better how things are clustering together, where you have kind of advanced manufacturing hubs, you have innovation clusters, you have financial centers, and all these things are kind of coming together and are being stitched together. For example, one of the things I read recently, I try to pay attention not only from a big picture macro perspective, but also from a bottoms up corporate perspective. And one of the real fascinating stories I read recently was about Nike. And Nike has now decided it's going to focus on 12 major cities around the world. And that's where the thought leaders are, that's where the cool fashion comes from, and that's where they want to be and they need to be to continue to drive growth in their business. And so they have identified 12 global cities that they are going to be active in, both as a seller, but also as a innovation center, as a consumer testing bed, as a production center. In those cities, interestingly enough, break down pretty well into the tripolar world thesis. There are 12 cities, and each region has 3 to 4 countries, 3 to 4 cities. There's no region which has more than 4. There's no region that has less than 3. None of those cities are in Asia. None of those cities are in Africa. None of those cities are in the Middle East. They're all either in Asia, Europe, or the Americas. So trade is going to be much more finely meshed. It's not going to be 3,000 miles. It may be 300 miles. It's going to be from you know, Tijuana, Mexico to Laredo, Texas. It's going to be from Warsaw to Frankfurt, as opposed to from, let's say, Vietnam to San Francisco.
So let's talk emerging economies. Will this be good? I mean, investors love emerging economies, and we saw the BRIC countries just basically fall apart with one exception. So are you expecting that we will see more emerging economies with the tripolar world, or are they likely to be living under the domination of China and Asia, the United States and the Americas and so on?
Well, the emerging economies have been emerging now, let's say, for, you know, 30-plus years. As I mentioned, I got my start doing non-Japan Asia back in the late 80s and then Latin America in the early 90s. So I'm very familiar with the emerging markets. And, you know, most of these economies are now reasonably developed and linked in to one extent or another to their respective regions. The true emerging, or what's now called as frontier economies, often are in Africa, some in the Middle East, a little bit in parts of Asia, for example, Pakistan, which is an important country in the One Belt, One Road project, and is also becoming, you know, potentially an interesting investment opportunity, in part because of the work that's going on in the One Belt, One Road project. So that's an example of how some of these economies may flourish in the tripolar world. Other examples are as I mentioned, Mexico has been a great investment this year. You touched on them, the emerging economies being attractive. One of my top five picks for my clients this year in 2017 was Mexico. Made that case in December. And basically argued that, look, if you paid attention to the integration of the corporate value-added supply chains across the U.S.-Mexican border, then you knew there was absolutely no way that we were going to break up NAFTA. Just not going to happen. And therefore, when all the concern about that arose, that presented a tremendous investment opportunity. And I'll just give you an example. The Mexican peso traded as wide as 22 or so pesos to the dollar, and today it's about 17.7 to the dollar. So not only has the stock market in Mexico gone up, but the currency has strengthened dramatically, and the total return in dollars has been roughly 25% to 30% year to date. So in less than 7 months, you made 30% by investing in Mexico because you understood through the tripolar world that the integration of the supply chains meant that there's no way that NAFTA was going to be broken up. As we touched on, the real question is, you know, can we extend NAFTA as opposed to breaking it up? And it's similarly true in Europe. I'll give you one other example that I found very interesting in Europe. With Brexit, obviously London being the key financial center in Europe, now being called into question. So there's a little bit of a food fight going on as far as who can get what pieces of financial business away from London to their respective countries and cities. And one city that's really making a big play is Warsaw in Poland. And they're making a big play for the back office functions that banks are looking to maybe move, simply because London's very expensive, real estate-wise and wage-wise, and secondly, because if the UK is not going to be part of the EU, then you probably want to have some of those operations in EU proper, which Poland, of course, is a European Union member, and Warsaw is a city that's making a big push for some of that back office business. So that's an example of how things which you may think of are negatives are actually quite positive for different places. And the trick is to have the framework to be able to understand which is positive and which is negative.
Your firm works with institutional clients. So what does this new world order mean for them? What are you telling them to do to prepare to prosper? Does it really change the investment schematic a great deal or not?
You know, a key question, obviously, right? At the end of the day, as I touched on a little bit, My business is advising institutional managers and pensions, et cetera. And so this is the key question. Okay, this is all well and good, but it sounds almost more like it should be in Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy magazine as opposed to, you know, an investment committee meeting about how do we allocate our capital. And my argument is that no, in fact, this thesis allows you to see the world in a different way, in a way which I believe at least is more realistic about the future than some of the ways we've been thinking about things in the past with this focus on monetary policy. And so when I engage with clients, it really goes right from the very top of the asset allocation process in terms of the asset class allocations. If you believe that the tripolar world thesis is starting to manifest itself, if you believe, therefore, that we may be seeing the lows in global growth and that we're on the cusp of a better growth profile globally over the next 5 or 10 years, and you want to be more heavily exposed to equities, and then you go into the region. For example, one of the key calls, I think, particularly in the equity side, is whether or not the non-U.S. developed economies are taking the global equity leadership baton from the United States. The U.S. has been, if you pull up a chart of global equities versus U.S. equities, you know, the U.S. has been by far the dominant performer since the lows in 2009. I argue, in part because of the tripolar world, that Europe and Japan and other developed non-U.S. economies are taking leadership from the United States equity market, and therefore you want to be over-allocated to research in Europe, as we touched on. And then you go into countries, and I won't belabor the point, but we've already discussed Mexico as an example for how you think about countries. You know, where is the opportunity? Where have people misunderstood what is happening? And instead of being fearful about the U.S.-Mexico relationship, it's an opportunity. That misunderstanding, that misplaced fear, presented a excellent entry point for Mexico, which is a big, important, growing, underbanked, underconsumption developed economy, where the opportunities for the next several years, I think, are going to be significant. And then you think about sectors, and we touched on logistics a little bit. Some of my best investments this year and recommendations have been in the logistics sector. And by the way, not only in the United States, but also in China. You know, when you think about China, everybody harps on bad debt and rising debt and poorly functioning state-owned companies, but there's a host of world-class technology companies that are based in China, and it's really come out of nowhere. 10 years ago, China had no real presence in the public technology space. It was all, right, 2000 was all about the U.S. dot-com boom. Today, 3 or 4 of the top 10 tech companies in the world are in China. And so, therefore, you have to look at China not only as a concern, but also as an opportunity. So you have opportunities in sectors like technology in China, logistics in the United States, banks in Europe. And then you get down into the private side. And I know a focus of a lot of your readership and folks who pay attention to the work of your publications are focused on the real asset side. And let me assure you, it's the same there as well. In fact, one of the signals to get more bullish on Europe last year came from the private equity side, where I realized that private equity focused in Europe had record capital raising last year, 2016, at the same time as the public equity market in Europe saw record outflows. And I said to myself, well, wow, that's got to present, somebody's wrong. And clearly it was the public markets that were wrong, because now they're reversed and come back in, and you have European equities in dollar terms up about 20% year-to-date, more than double the U.S. performance. But you also have opportunities in things like distressed debt, where finally the banking issues that have bedeviled, particularly Southern Europe and Spain and then Italy, are being dealt with. You have rising growth rates, which means the non-performing loan portfolios, which the distressed debt people love, are finally going to be able to be priced at a level that both the banks can sell, and yet the buyers are still interested because there's still upside. In real estate, we spoke about the Warsaw example, and I think that's true throughout the tripolar world, right? I think the opportunity is in much, not so much the top tier, most expensive cities, so not so much London, right? Not so much New York, not so much in the case of Asia, not so much Tokyo, though Tokyo is kind of interesting for other reasons, but really it's the second and third tier cities where, as I mentioned before, I think you have these innovation clusters, these advanced manufacturing hubs, and the stitching together of the real estate and thinking about real estate from a tripolar world perspective. And this, I've given some talks on this over the past year or so, most recently at an MSCI conference in the spring here in New York. But from a real estate perspective, thinking about the world in a tripolar thesis provides a very good understanding of where the opportunities might be in a real estate world, where certainly in the U.S. it's fairly fully priced. Certainly in most leadership cities around the world, real estate is not cheap, but you have the industrial space, which has been a great place to be in the U.S. The last couple of years, attractive in Europe, interesting in Asia because they don't have that much of it, and therefore the opportunity from the investment perspective of thinking about how does the world shape up if you overlay, let's say, a tripolar world perspective, I think it at least has to date offered some significant opportunities to allow one to take the other side of the prevailing consensus at the time and then benefit when that consensus is revealed to be incorrect.
This has been an interesting discussion, Jay. Let me wrap it up with one final question, and has to do with which of those regions will be most ascendant. You've already indicated that the Americas look like a little bit of a laggard at this point. Do you see the Europe or Asia as being ascendant, or is there going to be a dominant region, or do you think that Asia and Europe are pretty much going to be equally weighted?
You know, that's a tricky one to think about because there's so many moving pieces and different parts. But I have to say, at the moment, I'm very, very positive on Europe. If I had to pick one region over the next 3 to 5 years from an investment perspective, okay, so from the perspective of where can an investor, both in public equity or public assets, as well as in private assets, where is the most opportunity? To me, I think it's Europe hands down. Europe, if you think about the economy, has a tremendous amount of slack left in it, right? Unemployment in Europe is still 10%. They haven't come close to recapturing, for the most part, their GDP levels of 7 or 8 years ago. Credit-wise, the banking sector is finally starting to heal itself, but is many years behind the United States, and it's priced that way. If you look at price to book of U.S. financials of big cap banks, they're now well over one-time book value. In Europe, most of the banks are trading at roughly half of book value, maybe now after a rally, 0.7 times book. So you have a credit cycle that's yet to really kick in. You have a political cycle that is finished in Europe, right, with the election of the upcoming election of re-election of Chancellor Merkel in Europe. You do have an election forthcoming in Italy, but I think with the growth profile picking up there and the success of the bank program they've just implemented in the last month, with three of the major banks being restructured, I think it sends a good signal for the election outcome there. Whereas in the United States, you have uncertainty as to the policy prognosis for the U.S. And in Asia, you have, as you mentioned, some of the historical tendencies between China and its neighbors, as well as the Fall Party Congress for China coming up in a few months, suggests that there may be political uncertainty there. So from an economic perspective, from a financial valuation perspective, from a political perspective, I think Europe, and from the perspective of having really had to concentrate, leadership in Europe have had to really concentrate on the idea that with Brexit, the UK leaving, with the US no longer necessarily the indispensable ally that it has been for most of the post-war period, Europe is recognizing it needs to go it alone. And there are opportunities, for example, in the capital markets union, where you can really structure the banking system on a much more kind of region-wide basis on technology, the push for digital single market. Because right now, where Europe does lag is in technology. Technology, as I touched on in China, very, very powerful and positive. Technology in the U.S. and, by the way, in Latin America. Three of the top 10 internet markets in the world are in Latin America, interestingly enough. So technology in the Americas, technology in Asia, very strong. Europe is lacking in technology in part because they have not figured out how to make it one single digital market for all 600 million Europeans. That's most likely going to happen in the next couple of years, and it will happen because they recognize the need to compete and to have some European champions. And so when you ask about, you know, the outlook for, let's call it, 3 to 5 years, again, your clients being kind of real asset people, they have a longer time frame for their investments. To me, the opportunity on the table today is Europe.
Our guest has been Jay Polosky. He's founder and principal of Polosky Global Strategies. And you heard the argument. Globalization is waning, and we are headed towards a tripolar economic order. Jay, this has been a really interesting discussion. I appreciate you taking the time, and we'll look forward to revisiting this subject as things start to take shape.
Excellent, Mike. Thanks very much for offering me the opportunity, and I look forward to staying in touch with you and the team.